War of the Worlds, which was the renewal of, by CBS of the series. We just hired another writer, a new writer, who got all of $50 a week for writing of one full hour radio show. That was Howard Koch.
We asked Howard Koch how he became involved in the project.
I was doing the weekly radio plays for the Mercury Theater of the Air, Orson Welles and John Houseman. And the third assignment they gave me was a story by H.G. Wells called War of the Worlds. And Orson wanted it done in a different way. He wanted it done in news bulletin and first person singular and contemporary. Orson and I chose it. We decided the time had come we should be doing a science fiction show, and so we tried a few that weren't very easy to do, and so we fell back on that. And, you know, I was the one who assigned it to Howard, and when Howard got in trouble, I was the one who conferred with him, and that's when we decided to update it, mm-hmm. bring it to
and
the present day.
I told Houseman, who was working between the studio and my apartment on 72nd Street, that I didn't think I could do it. I had 6 days. I didn't think I could do it the way Orson wanted in 6 days. And I tried to switch him to another story.
So he had trouble in what sense? In the sense of
he
the
just
language?
He said it was dull. No, he said it was boring. Mm-hmm. If it was something that happened 50 years ago, everybody knows it didn't happen. So who the hell cared?
Right.
And word came back from Orson, no, I want this done. Go ahead, we'll help, go ahead. So I worked day and evening for those 6 days and got it done just before, with the last husband kept taking pages down from my apartment, 72nd Street, to the studio.
And by updating it, it immediately became an exciting show that made sense.
Mm-hmm. Big up! Look out there!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute. Someone's crawling
someone
out
or
something I can see turning out of that black hole, two luminous discs. And the eyes, it might be a face, might be almost... But heavens, something wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another one and another one. They look like tentacles to me that... Oh, yeah, I can see the thing's body now. It's large. It's large as a bear. It's glistens like wet leather, but that face, ladies and gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it.
So awful. The
eyes are black, and they gleam like a serpent. The mouth is a kind of V-shape with saliva dripping from its rimless lips. It seems to quiver and pulsate, and the monster or whatever it is can hardly move. It seems weighed down by possibly gravity or something.
Howard did a very good job. Then, as soon as we decided to update it, everybody's all pitched in. Everybody had ideas to make it more vivid and more real, except Orson. Orson, curiously enough, hardly saw that script before the day of the broadcast.
As John Houseman explains, sometime around 2 the afternoon of the broadcast, when the show began to take shape under Orson's hands, a strange fervor seemed to invade the studio, and the first to feel it were the actors.
It's starting to rain again. The rain had...
Mr. Houseman recalls actor Frank Riedick, who played the part of Carl Phillips, the network special reporter, had gone down to the record library and dug up a recording of the explosion of the Hindenburg at Lakehurst, New Jersey.
Oh, my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks agree that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's like 20... Oh, 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen.
Riedick played the Hindenburg recording to himself over and over. Then, recreating the emotion in his own terms, he described the Martian meteorite.
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. Wait a minute, something's happening. humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. The whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks, and the automobiles are spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
There followed a moment of absolute silence, an eternity of waiting. It was one of the many devices with which Orson Welles succeeded in compelling not merely the attention, but also the belief of his invisible audience.
Then, as usual, he did wonders. He is largely responsible for what I think is perhaps the most exciting thing about that script, about that show, is the timing of it. Mm-hmm. And Orson had a courage to do certain, to start that show so slowly that you almost couldn't believe anybody would stay with it.
On this particular evening, October 30th, the Crosley Service estimated that 32 million people were listening in on radios.
24 hours, not much change in temperature. A slight atmospheric disturbance of undetermined origin is reported over Nova Scotia, causing a low-pressure area to move down rather rapidly over the northeastern states, bringing a forecast of rain accompanied by winds of light gale force. Maximum temperature 66, minimum 48. This weather report comes to you from the Government Weather Bureau. We take you now to the Meridian Room in the Hotel Park Plaza in downtown New York, where you will be entertained by the music of Raymond Raquello and his orchestra.
And yet that's what finally made it credible, because if you start that slowly, the audience sort of settles in, and then when it starts to accelerate, they follow you.
If it was Orson Welles, the director, who was responsible for slowing down the pace of the broadcast to make it more believable, it was Orson Welles, the actor, who was able to sustain the dramatics for the rest of the program. Actor Arthur Anderson, who worked with Orson Welles on the Mercury Theater broadcasts, explains.
His young age had nothing to do with his voice. By that, I mean his voice was a very rich, round, full voice, and you would never guess that he was still in his teens.
I've been hiding in this empty house near Grover's Mill, a small island of daylight cut off by the black smoke from the rest of the world. All that happened before the arrival of these monstrous creatures in the world now seems part of another life. Life that has no continuity with the present. Furtive existence of the lonely derelict who pencils these words on the back of some astronomical notes bearing the signature of Richard Pearson. I look down at my blackened hand and try to connect them with a professor who lives at Princeton and who on the night of October 20th glimpsed through his telescope an orange splash of light on a distant planet. My wife, my colleagues, my students, my books, my observatory, my world, where are they? Did they ever exist? Am I Richard Pearson? What day is it? Do days exist without calendars?
And I then worked with Orson in radio, the Mercury Theater on the air, which later became sponsored by Campbell's Soup.
Howard Koch.
And of course, Orson and Hausman and their crew were very talented people, and they did an awfully good job at the production of it. They knew how to cast it. They knew how to time it. They did everything right.
We spoke to John Hausman in his New York apartment about what it was like doing live radio.
It was absolute chaos.
So give us a little bit of a quick scenario.
Well, it was a chaos because we never really, they were put on in something of a hurry, and they were quite elaborate shows, and we never really knew what our timing was. I mean, now that was not too serious because Orson was a past master at slowing or speeding, and his vocal capacities were such that if we were 10 minutes short, he could lengthen it, and if the return was long, he could speed it. And then we did a lot of editing at the last moment. That contributed to the hysteria. And Orson, by temperament, was also liked to work in the atmosphere of hysteria.
We asked Arthur Anderson what it was like working with Orson Welles on radio. He told us some anecdotes, such as one showing how Orson Welles loved playing practical jokes.
Philip Morris Playhouse, a half-hour dramatic show, one of those which in those days were done in Broadway theaters, which were hired by the broadcasting companies. The men were dressed in tuxedos, the ladies were in evening dress, the curtain went up, the lights went up, the orchestra played, and it was pure glamour, because after all, you were witnessing a coast-to-coast broadcast. Well, this particular broadcast, Orson had the opening speech. I don't know what the nature of the program was. He had the opening speech, and the announcer came before the audience and said, "Now, we're about to go on the air, ladies and gentlemen. I want you to be very quiet. I want you to know you are witnessing a coast-to-coast broadcast." All the actors were ready, everyone clearing their throats, and Orson was ready. And the director was about to give the cue when Orson's script dropped to the floor. Now, it didn't just drop to the floor, it dropped all over the floor. The pages were scattered over the entire stage. Well, there was panic as everybody rushed to pick up the pages of Orson's script to try to get the pages in the proper order. Page one, have you got one? Have you got two? Oh, here's page eight. Well, put it next to page seven. And all of this was sotto voce and frantic as the hands of the clock approached the time for the broadcast. And it would look like they weren't going to make it because they could not get these pages of the script together because it all happened only seconds before airtime. But just as the cue came, the show went on the air, Orson pulled the real script from the inside breast pocket of his coat. And I can imagine what the director must have been saying in the control room. Why you? And went on the air flawlessly. He loved practical jokes.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo.
We had extremely skilled people working. The actors were the best actors in radio. And radio is a hysterical medium anyway. And it didn't bother them. It didn't faze them. We had Benny Herman was a very temperamental man himself. So we had all kinds of terrible screaming matches with Benny over the music. Mm-hmm. But that was all right. That was sort of par for the course. He did that with everybody, and the sound men were expert sound men.
I think some of the best. They were really creative, because a lot of these sounds were on 78 RPM records, and to be able to spot a sound, which means to put the needle down on the record at exactly the right spot where the lion roars, or the waterfall starts, or the wave breaks. This required as much art as being an actor, in my mind. Maybe more, I don't know.
He's having an argument with the policeman. Now, the policeman wins. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's something I haven't mentioned in all this excitement, but it's becoming more distinct. Perhaps you've caught it already on your radio. Listen, please. Do you hear it? It's a curious humming sound that seems to come from inside the object. I'll move the microphone nearer. Here. Now, we're not more than 25 feet away. Can you hear it now? Professor Pearson?
Yes, Mr. Brooks.
Can you tell us the meaning of that scraping noise inside the thing?
Possibly the unequal cooling of its surface.
I say, do you still think it's a meteor, Professor?
Do you think that its success had something to do with the time period?
Of course. Well, it wouldn't... It probably would have happened anyway, but it happened much more easily because of the fact that it followed the Munich crisis by a couple of months. Two things happened there. One, people had suddenly, for the first time in history, become accustomed to getting their news out of the box
etc., out of the papers. That was number one. Number two, the whole atmosphere of crisis and anxiety was still very much alive after Munich, and I think it made it much more easy to be fooled by this broadcast.
Another important factor as to why listeners believe that what they were hearing was true was that the Mercury Theater aired directly opposite the most popular radio show at the time, the Chase and Sanborn Hour, with Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
Well, tell me, was the car badly damaged?
Well, it's sort of... Well, Bergen, why split hairs? Junk is junk.
Well, I'd like to see this car for myself. Now, just where is it?
Well, it's on Main Street.
Well, where on Main Street?
Well, between 5th and 8th.
5th and 8th? Yeah. Well, is it near 5th or is it near 8th?
It's all the way between 5th and 8th.
When Edgar Bergen introduced a new and not very popular singer about 8:12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, a large number of listeners began twisting their dials in search of other entertainment. Many of them turned to CBS, and when they did, they stayed put. For by this time, the mysterious meteorite had fallen at Grover's Mill, New Jersey, and the Martians had begun to show their foul, leathery heads.
Four companies of state militia are proceeding from Trenton to Grover's Mill and will aid in the evacuation of homes within the range of military operations. Thank you.
You have just been listening to General Montgomery Smith, commanding the state militia at Trenton. In the meantime, further details of the catastrophe at Grover's Mill are coming in. The strange creatures, after unleashing their deadly assault, crawled back in their pit and made no attempt to prevent the efforts of the firemen to recover the bodies and extinguish the fire. The combined fire departments of Mercer County are fighting the flames which menace the entire countryside.
Within minutes, people all across the country were praying, crying, and fleeing frantically to escape death from the Martians. The reaction to the broadcast was strongest at points nearest the tragedy. In Newark, New Jersey, in a single block, more than 20 families rushed out of their houses with wet handkerchiefs and towels over their faces. Some began moving furniture. Police switchboards were flooded with calls inquiring, "Shall I close my windows and have the police any extra gas masks?" Police found one family waiting in the yard with wet clothes on their faces, contorted with hysteria.
Excuse me, what was the atmosphere afterwards?
Well, it was very disagreeable because for at least a couple of hours or more, really until the next morning, we believed we were mass murderers because the press, which was very hostile to radio, was delighted at this opportunity to piss on radio and to say that they were irresponsible and so on. Did all the usual newspaper tricks. I mean, they would say, well, you've heard about the family that was killed on the highway in New Jersey. How many other deaths have you heard about?
The 50th anniversary of the War of the Worlds broadcast is now being celebrated, the opening of which was appropriately at Grover's Mill, New Jersey, where the fictional Martians first landed.
My name is Steve Dechter. I'm the mayor of West Windsor Township, and I'm here on behalf and with the support of the West Windsor Township Committee, our governing body, and welcome to Grover's Mill, West Windsor Township, on October 30.
Many of the townspeople got up and spoke about how they reacted to the broadcast.
I was on duty at the New Brunswick Station, State Police, and about 8:15, the call started to come into the barracks. I was on desk duty. The calls were coming in from people in the area wanted to know where to go. I didn't know what they were talking about. After a while, they said we're being invaded. We're being invaded by Martians. The calls kept coming in, and I would say within the hour, I received over 100 calls at the barracks. The local police in New Brunswick had people coming into the barracks and saying, which way shall we go? They have their car packed, they have their families in the car. They wanted to know which way to head for to get out of town. Trying to quiet these people down, they wouldn't even listen to the police. They said, no, it's a true story, come out to the car, we have it on the car radio.
That day, the operators of CBS had been given a lecture on
how to be more polite to people who are inquiring, making inquiries over the telephone. And, during that evening, the supervisor was walking up and down, and she was listening to how the operators responded to the questions that were coming in. And she heard one say very nicely, "I'm sorry, we don't have that information here." And the supervisor went up and complimented and said, "That was very nicely spoken. What was the question?" She wanted to know whether it was the end of the world.
I happened to walk into my house after being out somewhere and turned on the radio. And I did come break into this program in the middle of it when it sounded like a bona fide news commentator describing the terrible things happening to Grover's Mill. So I was quite startled for about 3 to 5 minutes, and I listened a little further, and they came on a station break or something, and I realized that it was just a story.
And I was at a youth Christian fellowship meeting, and there were about 10 or 15 of us in the room, and someone came barging in, opening the door, and said, "The Martians have landed, the Martians have landed." And we all looked at each other and wondered, the Martians had landed. And the very first thing that came in my mind, I said, "Well, I'm in the Lord's house, and I'm sure the Lord will take care of us."
There was no expectation on my part that that was going to create all of this furor. I even wondered whether it was going to be a good show, because I couldn't tell. Things were going so fast.
And so we really seriously believe we were responsible for a considerable number of deaths.
Which, of course, turned out not to be true.
Turned out not to be true. There were a few miscarriages, a couple of broken legs, mm-hmm. people slipping while they were running away from the Martians, but that was it.
They tried to reach me during the night to let me know about the panic and what was going on. But I was dead to the world and didn't wake up. So the next morning, I always had that half day off before beginning the new assignment. And I walked down 72nd Street to get a haircut. And I heard people's parts of conversation, invasion, war, so on, and I rushed into the barber shop and said, "Is Hitler moved? Are we at war or something?" And he laughed and he held up the paper with a big headline, "Martian Invasion Play Panics Nation," or words to that effect. And, well, that was a strange moment in my life. And, well, what happened after changed all our lives, Orson's, Hausman's, mine, everybody connected with it.
We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it and that both institutions are still open for business.
Well, you know, we were in some danger of losing our time on the air because of it. The police came in the next day and tried to get all the scripts, and they were pretty rough about it. But my script was up in my apartment, and copies could be made from that, of course, and have been. So it was touch and go for a few days, whether we were heroes or villains. And then Dorothy Thompson was a very popular columnist, important columnist, came out and said that we had done the country a favor because we had shown that in a real situation how people could panic and get some ideas of perhaps how it can be controlled. And that seemed to turn the whole thing around.
Mayor Dechter has a special presentation to give Howard Koch, which will be our last event this morning. Mayor Dechter?
Now, I would like to officially welcome Howard Koch to West Windsor Township by presenting to him this key to the township that 49 years ago his script put on the map, the national and the worldwide map. I want to present this key to the Howard Koch and hope that he nevertheless will remember this place. Okay. Put the clock down.
Some of you may be wondering why the first Martian machine landed in Grover's Mill.
We take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Carl Phillips again, out at the Wilmot Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Professor Pearson and myself made the 11 miles from Princeton in 10 minutes. Well, I hardly know where to begin to paint for you a word picture of the strange scene before my eyes, like something out of a modern Arabian night. Well, I just
it occurred to me that this was going to be in the form of a battle between two forces, our forces and the Martians, and that I'd better get a map so I could lay out the campaign. And I was passing through the New Jersey part of the 9W, that was then before the thruway, and I stopped at a gas station and I got a map. It was a Jersey map. And when I got to the apartment, I spread the map out because I thought, well, the first thing that I have to decide is, where does the first machine come down? So I picked up my pencil, closed my eyes, and put it down on the map. I looked, it was Grover's Mills, New Jersey. And that's how Grover's Mills became the focus of this attention which is going on now.
Why do you think that that there's still such an interest in the thing? Why it's so popular?
Well, I suppose it's like one of those things that people hear about and it's passed down until it gathers its own kind of momentum. Why people are, I suppose, too, that people, in a way, like to scare themselves.
As far as the popularity that it has today, even though it seems antiquated, people are still interested in it. Why do you
think it's that? It's history. I mean, it is one of the great, historically, it's one of the great events of the new age of mass communications.
And now, 50 years later, the War of the Worlds broadcast still remains a landmark in broadcast history. You have been listening to the War of the Worlds 50th Anniversary Special. The associate producer for this program was Thomas Babkowski. Remixing was by Glenn Brader. Special thanks to John Hausman, Howard Koch, Arthur Anderson, and the people of Grover's Mill, New Jersey, for their cooperation with this broadcast. The War of the Worlds 50th Anniversary Special was written, produced, and narrated by Joseph Bevilacqua. The War of the Worlds 50th Anniversary Special was dedicated to the memory of John Hausman, who died last night at his Malibu home.
On this Veterans Day, we bring you a story about radio during wartime, about U.S. soldiers in Vietnam and the broadcasts they listened to during the war. Radio voices fighting for the hearts and minds of the American soldier.
My radio was just like my rifle. My radio was wrapped up in black tape, wrapped up in a Prick 25 battery bag, taped down to keep the moisture out. Music kept me sane.
Far away up in the highlands, we had transistor radios. And in the middle of the day, way up north near the DMZ, you could listen to Diana Ross and the Supremes and all the popular groups that were out at that time. And it kept me feeling close to home.
From Saigon, this is the American Forces Vietnam Network, presenting Million Dollar Music for the Aquarian Age.
most American soldiers in Vietnam turned their radios on, the strongest signal came from the official military radio network. But they also listened to propaganda stations set up by the enemy and to unauthorized pirate stations rigged up by their fellow GIs. These underground stations and even the enemy broadcasts from North Vietnam became more popular as the war dragged on. But the big sound for Americans came from AFVN, the American Forces Vietnam Network. Bob Casey was production manager.
We gave the guys as much stateside sound as if WABC, which was then the god of all AM radio stations in the United States, was right in the middle of Vietnam. Not talking about the war, talking about other things. So the guys can turn it on and constantly have that sound from home. My show, which was on from 10:30 on a Saturday night from 10:30 at night till midnight, became the third most popular show in Vietnam. It was the oldie show. Again, in my feeling of entertaining the troops, I thought it was important that I get their heads out of Vietnam, get their heads out of the military, and to go back to the sock ops in high school.
Good morning, Vietnam.
I'm Romas Tiscus. I was in Vietnam in 66 and 67. I used to just roll my eyes. You know, you get this, good morning, Vietnam, it's a beautiful day out there. And I go, what in the hell is he talking about? You know, where in the hell is he broadcasting from? You know, we had just been mortared and rocketed.
Vietnam, hey, hi, hello, good morning all over your face. How do you feel? 7:20 now on the day after Thanksgiving, right? You have some turkey yesterday? I hope you did, as we kick open the doors to the Don Buster right here in the Big VN with Army Specialist Les Howard Jacoby saying, good morning, Vietnam.
They always try to keep everything upbeat. They were trying to project that you're at some surf party in Santa Monica or something. And when I was over there in 66 and 67, I can remember we listened to a very sexy, sultry, good-looking girl. I would have loved to have met her, you know, because you get these images that, you know, would make you melt in your shoes.
Oh, they're close.
And I'm sure that was done by design as well.
And if you haven't written me to play a song for your unit, why don't you do so today, okay? You can write to me, Chris Noel, care of the American Forces Radio and Television Service. The Ventures in the background with Aquarius Let the Sunshine In, which was a big one for the Fifth Dimension.
But, you know, getting back to my point, you know, after you've been mortared, you know, and your buddy is lying next to you dead or is screaming for a corpsman, it somehow just doesn't fit.
Some soldiers and DJs were resentful when songs were banned from AFVN, sometimes because of their supposed anti-war lyrics. Again, Bob Casey, formerly of AFVN.
We had to cut the middle of a song out. The cow sills and hair, oh, say, can you see my eyes if you can't? We had to cut that piece out of the record because some major somewhere thought that was derogatory towards our national anthem. And here, the cow sills, the all-American milk-drinking family of 1968-69, we had to forbid the playing of Cloud Nine by the Temptations. It had to do with marijuana. Or Satisfaction by the Stones because it had risque lyrics to it. We were censoring stuff to the guys that are in blood and guts. The last people in the world you'd want to censor anything from.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Army Specialist Bob Lawrence with 5 minutes of news compiled from commercial and military news agencies.
Military officials also tried to censor the news on AFVN. The network avoided stories that could hurt the morale of U.S. troops or politically embarrass the U.S. military. For example, reports of American setbacks in Vietnam or of anti-war protests back home. Jordan St. John was an AFVN newscaster in 1969.
We were totally controlled. The network there was totally controlled by the military apparatus. So we were, in fact, although called a news operation, we're really a propaganda machine for the military, and we couldn't say anything negative, even though that was reality. It was reality that there were anti-war protests going on. It was reality that troops were refusing to go out on certain patrols, to go down on certain trails, to take part in ambushes, and we weren't allowed to say that on the air in American Forces Radio, but it was in everybody's newspaper they were getting from home anyway.
Don North was in Vietnam as a reporter for ABC News during the war. He says that AFVN's optimistic war reporting made some sense in the early years, but that changed after the Tet Offensive in 1968, when the war expanded from remote provinces into the heart of Saigon.
Most of the GIs I knew sort of, winked at the news they heard, but not until later in the war, after Tet, did they really seem to be broadcasting such sterile news that it flew right in the face of reality, what the average GI was seeing. When you found in the height of battle, with the country coming to pieces all around you, and Armed Forces radio news consisted of what was happening at the state fair in Burning Stump, Montana, then its credibility became simply destroyed.
Vietnam vet Jerry Clark says the censored news made it harder for GIs when they finally came home to the States.
If I could have heard this on the radio and people saying, hey, when you get home, you're going to run into a mob scene. There's people back there protesting, us being over here. There's people spitting on people at the airport. Then I think it would have made things easier coming back here to the States for a lot of guys because, you're not part of what they call the great melting pot anymore,
Official military policy on censorship was the same then as now. The Armed Forces Network cannot air a story if it endangers troops in the field or if it would offend the host country where it's being broadcast. This issue resurfaced in Congress this past summer when Armed Forces Radio in South Korea censored news reports about student demonstrations and Korean human rights abuses. During the Vietnam War, the ethical questions over censorship were more difficult. Barry Zorthian, former spokesman for the U.S. mission in Saigon.
Because as things deteriorated in Vietnam, when there was a disruption and near mutiny in the ranks and some units and so on, it would be very, very tough to know whether to broadcast that kind of material or not, which was in U.S. news media. If you broadcast back to troops that Charlie Company is in a near mutiny, what are you doing to your troops?
Even Bob Casey, who objected to most music censorship, believed in a certain degree of restraint.
You don't over there start communicating that we got to get out of this place, even though that was the most popular song over there, very much banned by Armed Forces Radio for the song We've Got to Get Out of This Place. But the thing is that you didn't do that. I mean, the last thing you want to do is tear the guy's morale down. They could die if their expertise and morale do not stay in top form. And especially you don't want to blow a hole in the bottom of a ship when you're riding in it.
But there were radio stations that played the banned songs. By the time of the Tet Offensive, U.S. soldiers had their own ideas about propping up morale. An entire Vietnam counterculture had grown up. And with it, underground radio. With a different message of drugs, defiance, where the enemy was the U.S. military establishment. This radio underground began simply enough. A soldier could play radio announcer by lifting the handset of any combat field radio, finding an open channel, and talking. Marine veteran Bill Earhart.
Regularly, when you were out in the field, would use that band to would bullshit, and that we called it the bullshit band. And you'd be sitting around at night and get on and say, hey, hi, I'm from, Percocet, Pennsylvania, or wherever. Anybody out there from Pennsylvania? And people would talk back and forth on this thing. Well, about the fourth or fifth night that we were up at Contien, a couple guys from the bunker next to ours came running in, all excited, and told Wally, our radio man, that he had to turn on the radio, that there were tunes. People were playing music on this thing. They got him to turn the thing on. Well, he couldn't get anything. We're inside this bunker, so they tell him to put on the whip. This is a big, long, 10-foot thing that he screws in and sticks it out the door, and sure enough, here's rock and roll music. And it was certainly by no means sanctioned radio transmission. You were forbidden to use that open channel for anything except emergencies.
GIs did not just broadcast to each other over Army field radios. A few actually rigged up their own FM transmitters, creating pirate FM stations.
Good evening again, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host for the next 3 hours of hard acid rock music, Dave Rabbit, and my studio engineer, Pete Sadler. For those of you who have just recently come into the Republic of Vietnam, I'd like to give you a little information about it. We're an underground radio station here, and we say what we feel like saying, and we bring the truth to the first-termers in the Republic of Vietnam. We also bring you hard acid rock music all through the night. The up-to-date music of today's American youth.
Underground radio stations were not widespread and usually didn't transmit far, so many soldiers never heard them. But there were several broadcasting over the course of the war. Troops in the 101st Battalion tuned in the mysterious Kelly and his radio Lai K. The 11th Armored Cavalry heard Radio Black Horse. These stations served their own communities with a vision of public affairs distinct from the military.
Blowing a little grass now. Going back into music by Steppenwolf called The Pusher. Speaking of The Pusher, brothers and sisters, if you happen to be down by the Magic Finger Lounge anytime tonight, keep away from the Korean at the front door. He's pushing some bad H. I repeat, he's pushing some bad H.
You know I smoke a lot of grass. Oh, Lord, I popped a lot of pills.
Bill Davis was one of the radio pirates. He was also a high-tech aircraft engineer. And when he arrived at the Karat Air Force Base in the summer of 1969, he discovered that some of his colleagues had set up an illegal FM station in his barracks.
The station was mobile. It moved from locker to locker and barracks to barracks and around among friends and sort of a, you know, an underground network. It was a small gray box that was just hanging on the wall or stuck inside a locker. And plugged into, you know, someone's stereo, and they could have the whole thing locked up and it wouldn't even be visible. We played what we wanted to hear, and it turned out a lot of other people wanted to hear. It got to the point that it was being played in the hospital, it was being played in the chow hall. You could go around and hear it all over the place.
Though the military officially outlawed these underground stations, in certain locations, officers looked the other way, perhaps for the sake of morale. In any case, the military didn't knock itself out trying to shut the stations down.
It became a common thing at commander's call that they would, oh, by the way, do you have any information on a clandestine radio station being broadcast? And you go like, gee, no, I've never heard of it, you know, sort of thing. Occasionally they would come around in the back of a pickup truck with something that looked like a two-prong sort of fiberglass fork, and they were always pointing it at the same group of barracks there, and we just shut down. There was always someone sitting out on the steps. They would always yell, "Here, you know, here come the pigs," and it was fun. It was fun to do. It was exciting, and we were fighting back against the military establishment and against the war. It was a real in-your-face sort of thing.
Instant request line. Spencer Davis Group. I'm a man. This is a dedication to the United States Army. Army sucks. That was called in by General Creighton W. Abrams.
Vietnam veteran Doug Wellman.
In 1972, we were challenging each other to see what kinds of pirate signals we could broadcast. And my joke had to be taking a turntable up in this aircraft You know, the flight I did it, we had a crew chief who got an air medal or some medal for shooting down 7 of 11 MiGs. He was playing electric war game next to me, and I'm broadcasting Louie Louie and Aqualung to these pilots at the same time.
Besides these unsanctioned radio shows, there was another English-language alternative to Armed Forces radio, broadcasts from the enemy. By 1969, the North Vietnamese spent 4 hours a day broadcasting to American troops.
You are new here, and we don't expect you to believe us when we tell you how bad it is. It is a flat, scary jungle, thick with scrub trees and tall grass. Hot and wet in intermittent rain and strong tropical dragonflies and Viet Cong sniper bullets. You are a long, long way from Fort Riley now, and there is no JC Cafe in town on Washington Street where you can sit around the counter eating hamburgers and sipping coffee without having to be afraid a bomb might go off, like it did at that restaurant in Saigon a few weeks back. You can get killed here. Get out while you are still alive and before it's too late.
Of course, the U.S. had its own radio stations broadcasting propaganda and disinformation to the enemy in Vietnamese. The U.S. spent more money on propaganda radio. But the North Vietnamese were very resourceful. On occasion, Radio Hanoi let activists like Jane Fonda and Abby Hoffman broadcast to American troops. In other instances, the North Vietnamese broke into frequencies used by U.S. battleships and aircraft. Again, former Navy flyer Doug Wellman.
We were able to fly missions occasionally where we would get messages during the missions that pertained specifically to us. Say a secret mission, very quiet, and you're off the coast, and it's not like no one knows you're there, but you know that very few people